Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, President's Day, the 16th of February. We are going to talk about happiness this hour of the program. And our guest, Dr. Richard Davidson, says, in his view, we're largely off track as a culture. The scientific research suggests that people are quite poor at predicting what will make them happy. People often believe that material things, the new car, the new home, will have a lasting effect on their happiness, but the evidence suggests they don't. I think we have not done a great job in fostering a deeper understanding, he says, of what will produce more sustained increases in happiness. He says that he thinks the most important lesson he's learned about happiness is that it is best regarded as a skill that can be enhanced and also trained. And he has done just that with his studies. And I'm sure you've heard about some of them, particularly about the monks who have been going to the University of Wisconsin-Madison to have their brains studied because they've been meditating for a long time and what they've learned about brains. It's fascinating work. And our guest is Dr. Richard Davidson. He is William James and Vilas Professor of Psychology and Psychiatry and Director of the Weissman Laboratory for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior, Director of the Laboratory for Effective Neuroscience, and Director of the Center for Creating a Healthy Mind at UW-Madison. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dr. Davidson at 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. For you to join our conversation or send an email. You can do that as well, and that's talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. Hello, Dr. Davidson. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
I love reading about what you've done. I just think it's fascinating.
Oh, thank you.
Do we have an inalienable right to happiness?
I think so. I think it's part of our biological heritage, and I think that because of that, it's important that society recognize that and do what it can to promote it. And certainly in the United States, in the Declaration of Independence, it's very much encoded in the words of Thomas Jefferson. So I do think it is very much a part of who we are as a culture.
Mm-hmm. You talk about our culture, though, being off track here when it comes to happiness. Do most of us think it's the car, it's the new clothes, it's the house that will give us everlasting happiness?
Well, I think that in general, the research suggests that what people think will make them happy will not necessarily produce sustained increases in happiness. And so we're relatively poor at predicting what will make us happy. And I think in this culture there is an emphasis on the acquisition of material possessions and an implicit association of the acquisition of those possessions with the promotion of happiness. And the evidence clearly indicates that that just is not the case.
Right. Now, is it true that the Dalai Lama came to you and asked for you to study the brains of monks?
He did.
He did.
That's quite something. I first met him in 1992, and he was very interested in the promotion of scientific research in adepts, experienced long-term practitioners who had spent years training their mind in the tradition of Tibetan Buddhism, and the Dalai Lama has had a lifelong interest in science, and he clearly saw the potential utility of scientific research in this rather unusual group of individuals, and felt that this scientific research might help discover things which would be of benefit to all human beings in helping to relieve suffering and to promote happiness. And so he very much encouraged the scientific exploration of this area, and I've been trying to do this ever since I met him in 1992.
Isn't it something that that's what you do now because of the Dalai Lama? Isn't that striking to you every now and then? Look at what I'm doing here. I'm studying something that can be of great good to mankind, to humankind, because the Dalai Lama thought it was worth my looking into this.
It is a wonderful confluence of circumstances.
Right.
And had I been asked early on in my career whether things would have gone in this direction, I don't think I would have been able to accurately predict it.
Well, you may have become a monk, too, right?
I don't think I'm in any danger of becoming a monk.
So you have been not only looking at monks, you've looked at meditation teachers, you've also studied students who have been meditating for a shorter period of time. Tell me about the nature of the research.
It's broad and it's varied, and we've looked at different levels of experience, from rank beginners to individuals who have spent more than 50,000 hours training their mind, with many gradations in between. We have been interested in different types of meditation. The word meditation is a very generic term, and it's kind of like the word sports, which may refer to many different kinds of things, some that are more active, some less active, some done in groups, others more individual, and so forth. We have specifically been interested in meditation practices designed to promote compassion. That's one category. We've also been interested in meditation practices that are designed to focus attention and develop our capacity to monitor the contents of our mind. And we have been studying the different biological effects of these different kinds of practices on both the brain and the body. So we've been interested in how they may train the brain and also how they may influence the body in ways that are potentially beneficial for health.
Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? Physically, how do you do that?
To study the brain, we have used primarily two different methods. One is magnetic resonance imaging. We've used functional magnetic resonance imaging to look at the functioning of the brain using an MRI scanner. We have also used measures of brain electrical activity or electroencephalography that provide information on the electrical oscillations of the brain and how they may be altered by meditation. These two methods give us different but complementary windows on the brain and allow us to make different kinds of inferences about how meditation may be affecting brain function.
Mm-hmm.
To study the body, we have looked at a number of different things, including a very simple technique, which is where we've given people flu shots, standard flu shots, and we have examine blood samples before and after the flu shot that allow us to quantify the antibody titers that are mounted in response to the vaccine, and this gives us an indication of how effective the vaccine may actually be working. And some of our evidence indicates that in completely novice meditation practitioners who just were learning meditation in a two-month course where they went to a class once per week for 2 months, they actually showed significantly enhanced response to the flu vaccine compared to a group of people who did not go through meditation but who were tested at the same points in time. So these findings indicate that even short amounts of meditation practice in otherwise untrained individuals can have measurable effects that are beneficial in both the brain and the body.
Mm-hmm. What about this idea that in order to become really good at something, you need, what's the figure, 10,000 hours of doing this?
Yeah.
So did you find marked differences between those Tibetan monks who had practiced meditation for many more hours than that and those who had not practiced nearly as much?
We do find those kinds of differences, and this figure of 10,000 hours was not just a figure we pulled out of the hat, but it is a number that has come up repeatedly in studies of expertise of many different kinds. For an individual to be an accomplished musician requires at least 10,000 hours of practice. To be a master chess player to be a competitive athlete. All of these domains are very different domains of expertise, and all of them converge around this number of 10,000 as kind of being the entry level where accomplished skill really is apparent. And so based on that other literature on expertise, we use this figure of 10,000 hours to select participants for our research. And there is a big difference between those who have spent this amount of time compared to those who are just starting out. So practice really does matter. But having said that, it's also the case that even really small amounts of practice in otherwise untrained individuals can make a difference.
Let's talk about this. I guess we need to talk about happiness a little more here and how we define it and then the effects that it has on our bodies. You have said that there is evidence that levels of some virtuous qualities that appear to be associated with happiness, compassion, loving kindness, and clarity of attention, can also be raised through meditation.
Right. The evidence does indicate that each of these qualities can be strengthened through mental practice. And again, there really is nothing mysterious about this kind of claim. We regard these characteristics as fundamentally no different than any other kind of skill, which can be enhanced through training. It's just that in this culture in particular, we don't think about these qualities as skills or as the product of skills. Mm. We think about them as a sort of the givens, and they may be determined by our genetic makeup or by our early experiences, but once kind of we reach a young adult level of development, we're basically stuck, according to the dogmatic view, with these characteristics. And what the evidence suggests is that if you put in the effort and engage in this kind of training, you can change these characteristics. Just how much they can be changed, how much they can be enhanced, is really not something that we know at this point in time, and this is where the future scientific research needs to be done to answer these questions.
And so the result then would be that you go through life more optimistically, that you wake up in the morning charged and ready to go, that you have a better sense of humor, which is very important, I think, in life. What are the results of, I guess I'm asking you what it means to be happy?
Well, you know, that's a very good and important question, and it's the kind of question that's a little hard to answer with any kind of formulaic answer. When you're with someone who is really happy, you kind of know it when you see it. And so these are the kind of people we want to be around because we feel good being in their presence. They're the kind of people who have an infectious quality about them and who make you happy being in their presence. They're the kind of people who are kind and generous and make you feel very welcome and safe. They're the kind of people who bring out the best in those around them. These are all characteristics which I think are associated with this kind of quality of happiness. And one of the wonderful fortunes that I've had is being able to spend a lot of time around the Dalai Lama, who is an individual who, in my view, exemplifies these kinds of characteristics and is really a living example of what it is we're talking about.
I saw a picture. It's a striking picture because you don't expect to see this of you and I don't know how to pronounce his name. He's a Tibetan monk, and his name is Ricard, I believe,
yes,
following an MRI scan. And the smiles on both of your faces just make you smile. They make you feel good just to look at the two of you in this picture that's kind of grainy.
Well, that's kind of you to say, and it is quite striking to test these participants. They are very unusual to have around the lab. They do infectiously impact those around them, they are fun to be with.
Mm-hmm. The other thing that your studies have taught us is that we used to think, I believe, that we were pretty set in terms of how happy we were ever going to be, that we're either crabby or we're happy, and it's in our genes. And I believe that you've followed that as a you found that as a result of meditation, our brains can change. They're much more elastic than we thought they were.
Absolutely. One of the great discoveries in neuroscience over the past decade has been the discovery of the different mechanisms of neuroplasticity. And neuroplasticity is a word that we use to refer to the fact that the brain can change in response to experience and in response to training. It is the organ of change. It's the organ that was built to respond to training. There are data that indicate that the brain is plastic throughout life. That is, even though there are sensitive periods in our development when the brain is more plastic, there is also no question that the brain is transformable throughout the entire lifespan of an individual. And there are a number of different mechanisms of plasticity that have been uncovered and described. And there is some evidence to believe that practices like meditation may utilize these mechanisms of plasticity, and it's through these mechanisms that the brain can actually change in response to this kind of training.
Hmm. Is it hard to pick up? Is it hard to learn how to do this kind of meditation or not?
I don't think it's hard, but it does require systematic effort. It's some of the simplest skills in life require a lot of practice to perfect them. I think the same is true of meditation. It's fundamentally simple, but to really perfect it requires practice.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Well, we go to phone calls. Our lines are crowded, and we have some emails as well. Our number is 800-486-8655, and the email address is talk@wpr.org. We're talking about meditation and meditation as a key to happiness, and our guest has done these remarkable studies at UW-Madison. Dr. Richard Davidson is a professor of psychology and psychiatry, director of the Lab for Functional Brain Imaging and Behavior, and also for Effective Neuroscience, and director of the Center for Creating a Healthy Mind. I love that. Isn't that great? I work at the Center for Creating a Healthy Mind. That's great. He's with us this hour, and we're going to be taking your phone calls momentarily. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I just wanted to remind you that tomorrow during this time period, Senator George McGovern will be with us to talk about the recent book, and a fine one it is, on Abraham Lincoln, titled Abraham Lincoln. So George McGovern during this time period tomorrow. All right, let's go to phone calls. Carmen from McHenry, Illinois. Hello, Carmen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Could you please tell me where I could go to get some help in relation to training? I'm a 10-year chronic back pain person. The MRIs, the neurosurgeons say you have a really good-looking back in relation to the MRIs. You must have soft tissue injury. I used to be so happy, and it's taken the happiness out of my life, this pain almost constantly. Where can I go for some help?
Well, that's a very critical question. Thank you for asking it. There are a number of academic medical centers around the area where mindfulness-based stress reduction is taught. Mindfulness-based stress reduction, which is abbreviated MBSR, is a well-studied and empirically validated meditation-based method that actually was originally developed to help patients just like yourself who are affected and debilitated by medical conditions that produce chronic pain. And one of the important observations in using MBSR is that a patient's relationship to their pain can be positively impacted by this kind of meditation training. The UW-Madison here does offer classes in MBSR through the Division of Integrative Medicine. That's the place that I would most recommend you go to, particularly in light of your pain condition.
Right. And it's not too far from McHenry. It sounds like it's certainly worth a drive. Thank you very much for your call, Carmen. Let's go next to Dan from Wausau. Hi, Dan.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting program. As I was hearing you talk, I was actually reminded of Henry David Thoreau, who talks about, to quote Thoreau, he says, "Nature is hard to overcome, but she must be overcome." So with this mindfulness, the question I have for you is this just another fancy self-help approach to fixing oneself? Or what's your hope based on? Because when you said, if you put in the effort, you can change. So is this us trying to change us, or is it more like Thomas Merton contemplative prayer?
I think it's really both. The kind of mental training to which I'm referring is derived from the contemplative traditions originally, I think that you can find elements of it in many different spiritual traditions, although I believe that the beneficial effects of these practices do not depend upon them being in their original spiritual or religious context. I believe they can be made into a completely secular form and still be beneficial, and mindfulness-based stress reduction is one example of a completely secular approach that has utilized some of these specific practices from the contemplative traditions, but present them in a completely secular way. So, it also requires effort and training, and so I think that there really are elements of both the contemplative spiritual traditions, it is a family of practices that do require the effort and training.
Thanks, Dan, for the call. An email, two-part question here. When you talked about those 10,000 hours, how long a period of time can those hours be spaced out? And the other part is, are you looking for future research subjects? How can people sign up?
Okay, thank you for those questions. With respect to the first one on the 10,000 hours, at least a significant portion of the 10,000 hours in our long-term practitioners have been done in a very intensive way. All of our long-term practitioners did at least one three-year retreat where they were actually meditating for at least 10 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Oh, my goodness.
Three continuous years.
Oh, my goodness.
So that's very intensive. Now, we don't know whether 10,000 hours spaced in a more leisurely way would do the same thing. That is a question which is actually the focus of some upcoming research in our laboratory, comparing the same amount of practice done more intensively versus more spaced apart. With respect to signing up for studies, you can please go to our websites, and there's information about our ongoing studies there. And starting later this spring, we will be recruiting for another major meditation-based study. Participants will be needed for that.
Okay. And do you know offhand what the website would be, Dr. Davidson?
If you just Google my name, you'll find it.
Okay.
I can't give you the exact, I don't have the exact.
All right, just Google Dr. Richard Davidson, UW-Madison. Okay. Great. Thanks very much for the call. And let's go next to Daryl from Couderay. Hi, Daryl.
Hello, Kathleen and your guest. In 1971, I started meditating, and I meditated based on a book I got at the library. I was in the military at the time, and I continued like three times a day, about 15 minutes. But I had a question and a comment on happiness, a definition on happiness. But the meditation has helped me the most. I had migraine headaches, too, which after about 3 months of this subsided. My question, could a possible definition of meditation be a stopping of the world to recharge the psyche? And a definition of happiness is being more aware of yourself and your environment / experience, especially with your loved ones and at work.
Well, thank you for your comments, and I'm glad to hear that meditation has been helpful. Your definitions are certainly interesting ones, and I think they capture a lot of what these ideas are, or concepts are intending to reflect. So I thank you for them. There are certainly a number of other definitions which would also be appropriate, but if those work for you, then by all means, I think you can continue to use them.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for the call. I am interested in the work that you've done with young people. I know you've worked with a group studying, and maybe still are, K through 12 years, especially the middle school years. You talk about the pre to early adolescent period, a time of huge increase in all kinds of disorders that occur during adolescence. If a kid's going to make a wrong turn, often at that time, if you can help children through meditation to stay on track and minimize bad choices, it would be a great contribution. How is all of that work going?
Well, we're really in the early phases of that work. It's just getting launched. And so I think that there is a tremendous amount of promise in that area. But it's going to take several years before we have the hard-nosed scientific evidence in hand to suggest what methods may be most effective in kids of that age. I do think that there is enough scientific research now to suggest that this is a worthy topic of national investment, and this can be potentially very beneficial to kids of this age for the reasons that you've mentioned in your little introduction, plus to help them in school, to help them concentrate and focus. But it's going to take some time before we really have the evidence in hand. We are planning a large meeting on this topic, a public meeting that will be held in Washington, D.C. in October with the Dalai Lama to focus on education and contemplative practice. And it's the title of the meeting is Educating World Citizens for the 21st Century.
Oh, that sounds wonderful. Great. All right, let's go to Jillian from Madison. Hi, Jillian.
Yes, good morning.
Good morning.
Dr. Davidson, you frequently speak of your association with the Dalai Lama and your respect for the Buddhist philosophy, do no harm to any sentient being. How does this jibe with the invasive brain experiments you do on monkeys?
Well, I appreciate you asking that, and I have spoken on this topic on a number of prior public occasions, and I'd be happy to briefly address it here. First, let me say that the very vast majority of my work is with humans. Maybe 1 or 2% of the research I do is with monkeys, and contrary to some comments that have been written, I've actually never received a grant with me as the principal investigator for animal research in my entire career. So I really do very, very little of this, and what little I do is in collaboration with other investigators who are the principal investigators. I am interested in the all of my work in the eradication of suffering, and the work in animals reflects some very difficult and complicated choices about whether this work is worth doing to help reduce the suffering of others. They're not easy choices, and I think that we can be doing a lot better job than we are now doing, we being the scientific community in general, in terms of the treatment of animals and the treatment of animals with respect and with gratitude in ways that would minimize the suffering of laboratory animals. But I also believe that some animal research is extraordinarily important in developing new therapeutic methods to help with devastating disorders that are massive causes of suffering, of morbidity and mortality worldwide. And so it's with those kinds of considerations that I have been collaborating on a little bit of animal research. So I think that it's critical that we be mindful of what our intention is. It's critical that we do everything we can to minimize the suffering of animals involved in research. I do think that there are certain kinds of animal studies which are going to be extremely important for the reduction of suffering in others, and those are difficult choices that need to be made, and I have made those kind of choices in the past and expect to continue to make them in the future.
And thanks for the complete answer on that. Yvonne from Brown Deer, hi.
Good morning. Very important messages here today. I was born with depression, which was cured by a stroke 4 years ago. And what I experienced for the last several years was what I think was the first childhood I'd ever had. I'd never had that freedom from burdens and et cetera. I did have a good education, 12 years in a Catholic school. Christianity is the core of my philosophies, but I still have trouble. My early socialization was very poor, and I still have trouble feeling comfortable in groups. In family, I'm okay, but as for the happiness thing, I have found that in my grandchildren, in nature, gardening, animals, dancing, music, but I still have this sense that there's something between me and the real world.
Dr. Davidson.
Well, thank you for sharing that. It's very hard to say anything concrete in a specific case like this mm-hmm. without knowing a lot more. I certainly would think that contemplative practice can be helpful in the recovery process that you are engaged with, and I just wish you all the best.
Yeah. Do you think that mental exercise, like meditation, is just as important to us as physical exercise?
I do, and I often use that analogy. I think that in most Western countries today, most people now believe that physical exercise is something that is good for their health, and many people have incorporated physical exercise into their weekly routine. And among those who have, I think it's fair to say that virtually everyone believes that you can't just do 2 months of exercise and then expect that the benefits will remain for the remainder of your life unless you also continue. And I think the same is true of mental exercise. If we incorporated these elements into our educational curriculum early on, and this is one of the reasons I'm so passionate about the K-12 agenda, this could become a routine part of everyone's life. And so they spend a little bit of time each day on this kind of mental practice, which I think can have dramatic consequences for the future and would be something that they just routinely do as a matter of course. But, you know, it's often hard to get this kind of habit going. But once a person has tasted the benefits of it, it becomes easier and much more regular. But I do think it is very similar to physical exercise, or for that matter, any other kind of practice. A musician knows that he or she needs to keep practicing in order to remain at the top of their game, or an athlete. So it's the same kind of thing, and I think that regular practice is just very important in this realm.
Dr. Richard Davidson is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls, 800-486-8655. We are talking about happiness and the profoundly interesting and important work that he's doing at the University of Wisconsin-Madison on studying people who meditate, the Dalai Lama. It's a great story. The Dalai Lama asked him if he would study, because he's very interested in science, some of the monks that he works with to see what happens to the brain during the process of meditation. And the findings have been that this may be more of a road to happiness and to physical well-being than certainly those things that we thought could bring us happiness. So that's what we're talking about this hour. 800-486-8655 is the number. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to Joe next. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I've just started to get into Buddhism. And I've been learning mindfulness meditations to reduce the ego, because the concept of there's a self that can get hurt is one of the main causes of suffering, according to the Buddhist faith. And when I talk to Christians about this, a lot of the Christians say, you can't have morality without the ego, and I think my point kind of hits ahead. I was watching the news last night. I was watching ABC, the local WASA station, and a spiritual meditation teacher who was talking about removing the ego and just being happy with how the world is right now is coming to the WASA area. And the newscast actually spent most of its time talking about how local Christian groups are talking about how this guy is the work of the devil, and is promoting the agenda of Satan by teaching people to meditate and reduce their ego and find happiness in the world as it is now. And it's kind of disheartening and concerns me when theology kind of gets in the way of people opening their mind to possibilities and other ideas. And I guess I just wanted to kind of get your comments on the type of roadblocks we have in American society regarding Christianity and other theologies.
Well, thank you for asking that question. It's a rich, loaded question. Let me say that I think some of the problem arises from a confusing use of words that may mean, the same word may mean very different things in the different traditions, like the word ego. And my own view is that the contemplative practices, the meditation practices that we're talking about, are compatible with any religious tradition or spiritual tradition. They are not fundamentally one tradition or another tradition. I've actually spent quite a bit of time with a well-known Christian contemplative by the name of Father Thomas Keating, who teaches centering prayer, and the elements of this are very similar to the elements of meditation as I understand them. Although the research hasn't been done, I have some reason to believe that the effects that are produced by this kind of centering prayer practice are probably similar to the effects that are produced by, for example, mindfulness-type meditation practices. So I don't think that there is a fundamental incompatibility, and I think it would be best to avoid the use of words that potentially could be real obstacles because they are defined differently in these different religious traditions.
Thank you so much for your call, Joe. An email that has come in, there are gifted children who have musical skills. Sometimes after touching an instrument only a few times, they can play beautifully. Are there any cases of this in children with meditation? Do children somehow have very advanced meditation skills without coaching and training, Dr. Davidson?
It's a great question, and I think the most honest answer I can give is that we don't really know, because it just hasn't been studied. There are anecdotal reports of children who are really drawn to meditation at an unusually early age. These are kids from a Western neuroscientific perspective who may have very well-developed skills of focusing attention, and so they are able to engage in certain types of meditation practice with a kind of familiarity and facility which may be unusual for children of that age. In terms of a more research-based answer, we just don't have the evidence in at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Jeffrey from Delafield. Hello, Jeffrey.
Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Dr. Davidson.
Good morning.
I'm a nutritional microscopist, and I was wondering if you've ever enlisted a nutritional microscopist to study the quality of the live blood with respect to changing lifestyle choices, especially to do with happiness and health.
Well, it's a great question, and there certainly have been some studies of various biochemical correlates of well-being in markers, for example, of pro-inflammatory cytokines in various neuroendocrine measures like cortisol. Markers of inflammation, C-reactive protein, things of that sort. So there have been some studies of that kind. They are in relatively early stages now, and there's less that's been done specifically on the impact of meditation, but those are questions which are now being actively pursued in our laboratory as well as in the labs of other scientists throughout the country.
Thank you so much, Jeffrey, for your call. Steele is next from Nina. Hi, Steele.
Yeah, good morning. I was interested, us modern man overlaid with all our stimulus and ability to reason and, if you can make it in New York, you can make it anywhere. When you scan the monks, do you notice, does it fire more in the primal parts of the brain or artistic parts, reasoning parts, parts that fire when devising new weapons or... Where are they firing off at?
Well, that's a very good question. Part of it depends upon what specific kind of meditation they're doing. When they're doing meditation that involves concentration, what we see is the circuits that are implicated in focusing attention are highly activated. These are circuits that involve the prefrontal and the parietal cortices primarily. And these regions are differentially activated when the practitioners engage in this kind of focused attention meditation. When practitioners are engaged in compassion meditation, we see areas of the brain that have been implicated in emotion and empathy specifically recruited, areas like the insula, which is a part of the brain that is critically important in the interaction between the brain and the body. Has been thought to play a very important role in sending signals to the body as well as relaying signals from the body to other parts of the brain. So a lot depends upon what specific kind of meditation practice is under study.
Thank you, Steele, so much for your call. Another interesting email. Why has the Buddhist tradition focused so exclusively on meditation practices, and they seem to have minimized the physical practices? Are you doing any research, Dr. Davidson, into how the physical practices of yoga affect the mind?
Wonderful question. I think that this question really is accurate in suggesting that the Buddhist practices have more focused on meditation than on the physical practices. Although there are some yogic traditions within the Buddhist framework, but they have not been studied scientifically very much. There is some scientific research on the effects of yoga, hatha yoga, the physical postures, and you know, I think there needs to be more of that. There is relatively little, although again, this is a very recent area of scientific inquiry, and I think what we'll witness over the next 5 years is a huge increase in scientific interest in these areas.
Mm-hmm. Because certainly they've become extraordinarily popular in this country as well.
They have, and there is increased interest in evaluating them scientifically because people are spending a lot of out-of-the-pocket money on these kinds of methods.
Mm-hmm. Joan from Shorewood, hello.
Hello. Dr. Davidson, I certainly would like to talk to you in depth. You are at the right place. In 1949, I transferred to Madison, and as part of the Phi Ed department, I had to take one credit in relaxation, and that has made more difference in my life than all of the other classes I've ever taken.
A wonderful story.
But I have had my students, middle school students and high school students at a notorious school in Milwaukee, Bradley Tech, actually lie down on the tabletops and do the deep breathing and control of their own bodies and minds to do this. And it has worked with young kids to, before they'd have an art class, I'd say, come into the room, put your heads down, do deep breathing and visualize what I'm saying, and then I would sort of give them a soothing overall, and it calmed them down to a point. But my serious question is, two, as a senior citizen, we are always asked in medicals, are you happy? On a scale of 1 to 10, where are you? Well, a glass is half full or half empty. Either you get up in the morning and you say it's going to be a good day, or you can say, oh, it's going to be a bad day. Have you done any studies or any relationship to the Amon Clinic? My daughter is extremely intelligent, but she went through the Amon Clinic in California, where the man who wrote the book, Change Your Brain, Change Your Life, and they found that part of her brain was going just way too fast. And that's why she was always impatient with anyone who didn't see things as fast as she did.
Dr. Davidson.
It's very interesting reflections. I honestly don't know much about the Amon Clinic, and so I would hesitate to comment, but thank you for sharing all of that.
Yeah. Thanks, Joan, very much for your call. Dimitri is next from Milwaukee. Hi, Dimitri.
Hello, Kathleen. Dr. Davidson, how are you? I have a quick question for you, and also wanted to ask you to speak, if you would, briefly on your on the events taking place in Madison and Milwaukee regarding this particular issue. Could you speak to the theoretical application of meditation in prisons?
I certainly could. I think that there is a great opportunity and potential for meditation to be used in the prisons in a way which I think can be therapeutically very effective. And there is a critical need for scientific research to be done in this context to examine the impact of meditation in the prison system in minimizing recidivism and in improving the mental health, decreasing substance use and abuse, decreasing violence, et cetera, among prison populations. I think it's a perfect venue in which to examine the impact of intensive meditation in particular. And in both Milwaukee and in Madison, I believe March 25th and 26th, there will be a showing of a documentary film called The Dahmer Brothers, which is a documentary that has been made of a maximum security prison in Alabama.
And on that note, we have to say goodbye. We'll direct people to Google your name to get more information. And thank you so much for being with us. It was a fascinating hour.
You're most welcome.
Dr. Richard Davidson, and if you Google Dr. Richard Davidson at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, you'll get directed to the website of all the work they're doing. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, Rob Schroeder on-air production. Thanks for your calls on the Ideas Network.